Onto another example. This is a fair value hedge example, and it's one that is quite common among financial institutions, particularly some of the government agencies, but also banks use this as well through callable trust preferreds and the like. This is the example of an issuer issuing a callable bond and then entering into a cancelable swap against the bond. The purpose is to create low-cost floating rate debt by buying an option at a low price from the corporate investor market or the bank investor market, and then selling it to a swap dealer at a higher price and subsidizing your floating rate cost of funds. Is everybody fairly familiar with this sort of transaction? Okay. Is the shortcut method available? Well, this is evolving. The FASB, or the DIG, has explicitly carved out shortcut accounting for this type of transaction. Even though the debt's prepayable and the swap is prepayable, they've said, all right, well, so long as the coupons match, the maturity matches, and all the terms are standard, you may have shortcut accounting. However, there's still the issue of whether the swap had fair value at inception or not. Now, what's commonly done in these sorts of transactions, has been commonly done over time and is still happening today, is that the bonds are issued at a discount to pay underwriting fees to the underwriter. So the issuer may collect 99 cents on the dollar from the underwriter. What's typically done is the swap counterparty pays a point to offset the fees, to essentially make the issuer get par in the door at the outset of the transaction. Mainly this is done as a convenience so that the issuer can simply look at their floating rate, LIBOR plus 20, and know that's my cost of funds, and not have to figure out LIBOR plus 20 at 99, what's the all-in yield of that? That's mildly complicated to do. Now, it's not entirely clear that this upfront payment will remove shortcut accounting, but it is entirely possible that it will. It's also a very difficult thing to fix after the fact. Fixing it after the fact would require the issuer to make a payment to the swap provider and the swap provider to recoup on the floating leg. Nobody likes to pay cash out the door, especially over an accounting convenience or inconvenience. So what certain clients have asked is, dimension this. If I don't get shortcut accounting, how much noise through my income statement could I expect to see in a real-world example? So what I'll go through is a fairly extreme case, a 30-year bond callable in 5 years and a 30-year swap callable in 5 years, and look at how much income statement noise you could expect to see if there is no shortcut method available. The cancelable swap, the derivative, obviously has a number of drivers of value: yield curve shape, strike price, is it a premium call or a par call, when's the first call, what's the final maturity, implied volatilities, and so on. But in the example before, most of those features are structural, and most of those features will be offset. For example, the strike, the fixed rate, will be offset because it's the same in both transactions. The maturity and time to call will be the same in both transactions, and so on. So what this really boils down to is there are two drivers of value that you need to focus on. One is the swap spread versus the bond spread over time. That'll be a source of ineffectiveness. And second is the implied volatility of the option embedded in the bond versus the implied volatility of the option embedded in the swap. Again, we took a historic sample. The top graph shows treasury yields over a period of I think it was 2 years. The second graph shows 30-year swap spreads, the green line, and then 30-year new issuance spreads for this particular issuer in the sort of brownish line. And the bottom graph shows swaption implied volatility over the same time span. And so we'll test each of these independently and then together and get a handle on what sort of ineffectiveness you'd expect to see from this kind of arrangement. First, let's tackle spreads. Had hoped this would come out a little clearer. What you're looking at here is, in the top graph, gains and losses on changing, remarking the fair value of the debt for spreads and gains and losses for revaluing the swap for changes in swap spreads as well. The green ones are, the green lines are the debt gains and losses, and the brown lines are the swap gains and losses. It all consolidates together in the bottom graph. You can see that, you can see the amount of ineffectiveness of the two spreads net of each other. And you can eyeball it and see that, well, it's pretty much within plus or minus a point. And if we recut the data this way, you can see that there is a distribution, but it's fairly tightly packed. The largest gain was 1.61 points in any one period, and the largest loss was 1.18 points against you, just for spread changes. The average is zero, as you would expect, if things reverse out over time, or if these spreads are being reversed. Yes?
Tim, what's the standard that's being used for the time period on measuring effectiveness, and is it a, can you use a rolling time period, or is it a discrete time period?
That we're going to learn about on Thursday. That's one of the issues before the dig for this Thursday is do you measure period to period, or do you measure from the outset? I've measured period to period here. The very least you would need to do is at each reporting period, so quarterly.
But if you could do it quarterly but do a rolling effectiveness, then you would adjust what you booked in the prior period.
Right, exactly. And we'll find out what the actual, if they actually do produce a clear decision on this one, we'll find out what it is, what the expectation is. Then you could think, well, should I do any more frequent than that? Can I do weekly or daily even? Do I want to highlight any ineffectiveness immediately when it takes place, or just wait till the end of the quarter and see how I did? Different ways of looking at it. Anyway, let's take a look at the same sort of analysis, but for changes in implied volatility. I have argued that a bank in this situation could argue to its auditors that, well, implied volatilities are very difficult to measure in the marketplace. I can see swaption implied volatilities easily. There are broker screens for it. But isolating the implied volatility of my bond is difficult because I have to assume an option-adjusted spread. It's sort of pushing on two sides of a string. If I assume a high OAS, I have a low implied volatility. If I assume a low OAS, I have a high implied volatility, and so on. So it's a number that is difficult to measure and is subject to the assumptions that you have to make to measure it. So I would argue that a case could be made to an auditor to say, I will assume that implied volatilities on the swap and the bond track each other perfectly. And I'll make an I'll bolster that with an indirect argument that I can look at the agency new issue screens on Bloomberg or Telerate and observe, well, the Federal Home Loan Bank and the other agencies issue callable paper across the curve day in, day out, through all sorts of rate environments and volatility environments. And I know anecdotally that it produces funding in the LIBOR less 20 to LIBOR less a quarter area, but it's within a fairly finite band. So I can infer from that that the two volatilities have to track each other very well. Otherwise, I would see periods where there was no issuance of callable paper when the vols didn't work, or I would see periods of extreme issuance of callable paper where the vols were very, very favorable. But I can infer from the fairly steady state that they track each other. Now, assume that argument doesn't work. Then what? To do this, I've made some worst case assumptions. I've said I can look at swaption volatility and see it. And as a proxy for bond volatility, let me assume the worst case. It never changes. So I've got one thing changing, one thing not changing. That'll produce a lot of ineffectiveness. Under those assumptions, for implied volatility, the largest gain over this time period was about 0.75 points. And the largest loss was about 0.6 points. Again, with an average of zero, because the pattern's pretty much reversed out over time. Now, as I consolidate these two things together, sensitivity to spreads and sensitivity to implied volatility, we can see that the distribution is actually a little tighter than the spread distribution. So there's something of an offset. There's some correlation in there. There's something of an offset from including the volatility change, even under very bad assumptions. So in this case, the largest gain on this position is about 1.35 points, and the largest loss is about 1.5. Again, with an average income statement impact pretty close to zero. 85% of the observations, I believe, here are within plus or minus half a point. So what this does is, if you're contemplating issuing 30 non-call 5 debt, it's taking it back to floating for funding, this dimensions how much income statement noise you could have if the shortcut method doesn't pan out. And then you have to put this in the context of your own financials. If it's a $100 million issue, you're looking at maybe plus or minus $500,000 to income. Not really material, may not show up. You may want to just capitalize on the opportunity when it presents itself. If you've got a $2 billion program, you're looking at plus or minus $10 million swings in income. Maybe this isn't so appealing after all. Maybe this will start to have a real EPS impact period to period. Even though you know it'll reverse out, it's still, well, you can be pretty darn confident it will reverse out. It's still some noise that you'll have to face and explain to your equity investors. Some